Hello, listener. It's Tiny Giant Jams, back with a fresh episode. Isn't that right, Kerry Harrison?
It is indeed. Hello, listener.
Now, question for you.
Yeah.
Big question.
Yeah.
Personal question.
Okay.
Going to hit you right between the eyes with this question.
Alrighty.
When was the last time you had a great idea?
This morning.
That's great. That sounded a bit accusatory for him, wasn't it? As if you were going to say, you know, weeks ago. No, this morning. Yeah. Brilliant. Brilliant. Now, and why is the notion of a great idea relevant to today's podcast?
Because you're talking to the brilliant Dave Burse.
I am so.
Yeah, and you're going solo today. I'm not able to make it, so I am just me and Dave. Hearing it.
Me and Dave riffing.
Yeah.
He's many things, but we are going to cover many areas. But no doubt we are going to talk about his recent book, published in November. It was top of the Amazon philosophy charts at one time. Rather strange turn of events, but interesting nevertheless. That was his idea. It was a great idea. And should we say hello to Dave?
Yeah, let's crack on.
Hey, Dave Burse. How are you today?
I'm very well, thank you indeed. And
hello, listener. How are you?
Now, I've got to say, I'm in the throes of a crisis.
Are you? Oh, yeah. Tell me. Well, come on, lay it on the table.
Basically, right, it's a sort of confessional, but I am a man who's in need of some great ideas, right? Do you know anybody who can help me right now?
Well, I not really, no. There's a bloke down the pub that I know who's always got ideas, but usually crap.
Mostly about Brexit, I'd have thought, no doubt.
Yeah, mainly. So see that bloke there?
Now, come on, no joking aside. Look, I've got Dave Burse here today, listener, and it's very, when you say I list out what he is, it's very difficult to say because, to be honest, that would take up most of the podcast.
Yeah.
Because it's like you said as we were sort of setting up, you're something different every day, aren't you?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, today I'm a man.
Yes.
And I decided that would be the way forward for the rest of the day until at least 4 p.m.
Yeah.
There's so many different things I do where today, as I was telling you before we started recording, I accidentally woke up at 6 o'clock this morning. I sneezed myself awake.
What would your normal
sneeze? Have you ever sneezed yourself awake?
No.
No, it's not pleasant.
It's the experience, perhaps.
Well, so you wake up with a sneeze.
Triggered by the dream.
Could be. But I sort of woke up with a sneeze this morning, and then, of course, you're like, oh, I have to get a tissue. And 6 o'clock in the morning, and I thought, well, I've got lots of work to do. I may as well just get up.
I'm surprised that I would have thought, you seem quite productive. I would have thought even by the time we finished this podcast episode, you'd probably written another book, right? I would have thought that you were a sort of 6 o'clock up in the morning sort of guy, no?
Well, when I was writing my last book, I don't know if I can say it's my last book. It was several books ago. This one, How to Get to Great Ideas. For about half of that, I was getting up at 5:30 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I would start at 5:30 just because it gave me that wonderful, clear brain time. Before my family got up, and my wife and my daughter would get up at 8:30, and I would have already had 3 hours working. And to be honest, that undisturbed time is pretty much a day's work.
Yeah.
So I would get that done, and then I would go to the gym, and I'd work from the gym.
Right.
So I'd go into a different mode. It would go from the sort of tapping of the keys that I'd been doing from 5:30 to 8:30, which is a doing thing. Then when I went to the gym, I'd go into a thinking mode. And so I believe that thinking and doing are separate brain modes.
Mm-hmm.
So the thinking bit, I would take a notepad and a pencil to the jacuzzi. Great place because you're not connected to the web.
Is that really
you're
gym relaxed. In a jacuzzi?
Yeah, well, it was for me.
Okay.
That's what I like a gym for.
Does that
for.
Get you fit?
No, it gets you relaxed.
Okay.
And it cuts you off from technology. So
yeah.
So a lot of the stuff that's the thoughts in the book, I actually drew. So I would think graphically.
Yeah.
So if I wanted to think differently about something, I would map it out using drawings, and then I would work out the flow of things, or I'd use that to sort of map my understanding of how the brain worked, to see if I could think about it in a different way. And by drawing, because normally you do things in a very linear fashion when you're writing things.
Yeah.
when you draw, you're no longer working linearly. You're working in a spatial realm, and that's a very different way of thinking about things. And it would flag up interesting thoughts. And then I would maybe go to the computer, get dressed first. Dry off and get dressed.
No one's judging.
Well, I mean, I just want to make that clear.
Yeah.
And we'd then sort of sit at the computer and I'd do a little bit of research, see if I could find if there's any studies backing up my new way of thinking.
Yeah.
And then that would start to form the bones of what the book became. So I would have different modes. I'd have my thinking mode where I would separate myself from technology and I'd write with paper and pencil. And I would have my I'd have my doing mode, which was research and typing out the words. So I've been very much trying to work out the way that I work best. And that, for me, is the way I work best. But normally, I'm a lazy bugger. I'd happily sleep until 10 in the morning.
Amen. They got the sneezing attack today, really. So let's retract a little bit. So roughly speaking, you've 25 years in the industry, whatever the industry is.
Whatever that, yeah.
I mean, you again, we'll put links into the podcast episode of to you and all the things you've done. On that sort of career journey, and I never like to use the word Jed to this point.
I don't even know if I'd call it a career, but yeah.
An assortment of random time fillers, so I'll call it that, right? Do you think all those kind of experiences came to... I mean, you have written several books, right?
Yeah.
And you go all over the world. You give these talks and you do all sorts of crazy stuff and interesting stuff. And you go front of camera sometimes, don't you?
Mm.
Do you think that... What's part of those experiences across those years? Because at some point you were a callow... entry into a creative into their first footsteps. What do you think kind of created the circumstances of the you now?
Well, I mean, it goes way, way back beyond that. It goes to my childhood.
This is like therapy.
Yes, being Scottish.
Yes.
My mother grew up in a place called Helensburgh, and she grew up about three, four streets away from a guy called John Logie Baird, the inventor of television.
That's for the millennial listeners, John Logie Baird.
Yes, look him up on Wikipedia. He was the inventor of television, not just the television itself, but the broadcasting units and the cameras and everything. Incredible guy. And
because he'd need to have done that, wouldn't he? Because if he'd have made a television without the other things...
I know, it'd have been rubbish. You know, it's like there's a Larson cartoon. It was just like the days before television, and it's just a family sort of sitting, looking at a space in the corner of the room, you know.
Yeah.
So it'd been a bit like that. But, I mean, he was an incredible guy, and it got me interested in the fact that my country people were just so innovative that we pretty much invented the world. So we invented... tarmac. We invented rubber tires for cars, pneumatic tires, the steam engine, the steamship, of course, anything to do with steam and getting steaming.
Yeah.
We invented getting steaming. Yeah. Yeah. We also invented the hypodermic syringe. We invented penicillin. We invented the telephone. We invented logarithms. We invented refrigeration. We invented toasters. We invented the adhesives in the back of postage stamp. It goes on. It goes on. Mm. And to me, that was so exciting as a kid, being part of such an innovative nation, that I felt that I wanted a bit of that. So the ideas became a big thing for me. I was always fascinated with how problems were solved.
What kind of age are we saying here, just to build
a... This would probably about, maybe about 6 or 7.
Okay.
So really quite early. So to me, I was always quite mathematical, and I'd be trying to sort of solve problems in my head and do stuff. So it was very sort of logical and mathematical.
Mm-hmm.
And then I went to university and I did computer programming and advanced mathematics, which is not what you'd imagine someone like me doing.
Oh, it's the first thing I thought.
And then couldn't get a job as a computer programmer. And
before you went and did that degree, were you actually into computer programming as such?
Yeah, I was into hacking.
Right.
So I mean, even back in the sort of mid-80s, the school that I was in got a computerized system for the library. And the first week, it had taken them ages to get this sorted out. And the first week we had it in there, I hacked it, and it was down for a month. So I was, and I was offering to fix it, and they wouldn't let me anywhere near it. And I'm telling them how to fix it. But so I've always been interested in that. And I guess even my approach to coding these days, when I do occasionally code, is
still deep in the code.
Oh yeah, yeah. Okay. It's still as a more hacking than programming.
Yeah.
So I'll take pieces of code that are already there, and I will manipulate them to do what I want.
Right. Nice.
So I still do a bit of that.
So it started way back then. So then let's fast forward a little bit into your creative career and the experience you've had, and you become CD at various agencies. What kind of learnings? What did that bring to your mindset that became, say, like who you are today and the things you do?
I think
what was the good and the bad of it? Agency life. Wow.
Well, how long have we? How many podcasts do you want the series to be?
We can run it as a micro series. We've got the Barbican. By the way, ladies and gentlemen, we're back in the Barbican again. This could become a mini set.
Oh yes,
the Barbican talks.
It's like an arts program, isn't it?
It's quite classy.
It's all a bit chin strokey. So, for what I learned, let's look for the positive things. I learned that the advertising industry is full of incredibly talented people,
mm-hmm.
and I learned a lot about them because I'm this annoying guy that asks lots of questions. So I'm really curious about stuff. So one of the fabulous things about being an advertising creative and being this sort of young kid in his 20s working in advertising, you know, I'm at the age of 23 and I'm making TV ads. And wow. you're
in the capacity of writer, designer,
I was
conceptual guy, pointed the camera.
I was both a copywriter and an art director at different points in my career. I ended up being head of art at one agency and head of copy at another. So I've been
there's more evidence of your fluidity.
And what I discovered at that age, I'd be on a film set, and I'd be asking the director, right, why have you got the lights set up in this way? What does this camera do?
Oh, what's I bet that? He loved you.
And but actually, they did, because, you know, it's actually kind of nice when somebody asks you what you do and why you're doing it. It mm-hmm. makes you think about it, and you learn yourself. So I managed to learn so much from working with incredible photographers, film directors, doing lots of stuff in recording studios for voiceover, and all sorts of things that... Even the world of print and design, working with fantastic illustrators, I just learned so much. And I would just be constantly trying to find out how they did what they did, what made them good at it. And that curiosity, I guess, is what fed where I am just now. Mm-hmm. Because in many ways, after 20 years in the world of advertising, going from above-the-line stuff to then, because I could code, when the internet started to get big in the late 90s, I'd be... in creative departments, or come up with a campaign, and then I'd be going, we could also do this thing online. Well, we don't have anyone to do that. I'll code it.
Do it, yes. Exactly.
So I accidentally became a digital guy. So I got known for doing digital stuff. But digital's never been my one home. I'm just interested in all media.
Mm.
I'm interested in the connection between creating something and somebody consuming it.
Platform neutral.
Yeah.
Is that a term? Well,
yeah, it could be.
It is now.
So that's why I've ended up, I don't feel as if I've made a massive leap going from the world of advertising to the world of stuff in between the adverts,
mm-hmm.
which is more where I am now. So writing the content for magazines and newspapers rather than the ads for it, doing the TV shows rather than the annoying 30-second chunks in between. To me, it's just an extension of the same thing. It's you create something and somebody consumes it. And my job has always been to try and transform the audience, where they start in state A and you want to transform them into state B.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the job of marketing, but it's also just the job of a communicator. So I guess that's what I consider myself now.
I must say, hearing you talk of your various experiences, I always think in that sort of ad world, because we kind of share some of that kind of same experiences, is I always like the holy sanctity of the voiceover times, isn't it?
Oh,
when you're in the
it.
In the room opposite the artist, and you get them to nuance a word slightly. It's so dead acoustically. It's something really.
It's one of these things that having done it and being the copywriter who's been in the recording studio going, I just wonder, could you just change the inflection on that sentence there? If you just go up a little bit at the end, a bit more question, make it feel as if you're wistful. You know, it's all this kind of stuff, and you're giving that kind of feedback. And then in the last few years, I've found myself doing voiceover work.
You are the voiceover, eh?
Coach again. Ladies and gentlemen, you can hire me for my silky, chocolatey voice. And you then have somebody else telling you, could you do it with a bit more of a smile in your voice? and you know, inside your head, you're screaming, bug off! But you're like, yeah, I've been that person.
Which is a very useful, I was going to say, isn't it useful to walk in the other person's footsteps before making a judgment or so? So let's talk. So you have written several books, but the book that we sort of came into contact recently was around the around November time, wasn't it, last year when this was published. Perhaps we can start about, I suppose, first and foremost. Everyone's got a book inside them, they say.
Do they? They should see a doctor. I can recommend a good surgeon.
But in this particular case, before you got down to the creative process, I think it'd be quite nice to talk about that. I know we've touched upon the jacuzzi times, but some of the stuff, the great stuff's in here. What was your motivation for actually thinking that this was the thing you wanted to communicate to the world? Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is a book called How to Get to Great Ideas by Dave Verse, available in all good...
Available in all good bookshops and Amazon.
So you ended up, didn't you? This is the thing I was saying then. You ended up on the whole bunch of, thanks to your canny advertising and marketing tips, top of the philosopher.
Yeah, it was the top book for philosophy for about a week and a half.
Not bad work.
Which to me, it was that... I just thought that was hilarious that I could have written a philosophy book.
Zen Dave. Zen.
I guess because there's things in there where I'm talking about ways of thinking, I'm talking about attitudes and approaches and how to change things, I guess.
Just kind of, it's a philosophical slant. So will your next book be a sort of existential thing? Maybe some adventures. Adventures in Nothingness by Dave Burks. There you go. Right, so where did this come from?
Since I quit advertising in 2010, I've been doing, you know, I left advertising thinking that I knew what creativity was, and then I started to go into companies, and you'd get this stuff that would happen. You'd go into a company and they'd say, I wonder, can you help us teach us some brainstorm techniques? And inside my brain, I was screaming profanities, but I'd be saying to them, well, it's not really how it works. Yeah, but that's what we want you to do. And it's like, okay, sure, I need the money. So I would teach them these techniques, but it was getting it completely wrong. So I found there's been so many misunderstandings about creativity that I was encountering. One of them, of course, is going to organizations and you say, right, we're going to have a meeting to help us come up with ideas to help solve a problem. And there would be some people who would just put up their hand and go, not me, I'm not creative. And it's like this idea that there's a binary thing that some people are creative and some people aren't. And that kind of thing, it just started to annoy me. And I was realizing that, oh, my old industry and a lot of the arty people that I've worked with are actually responsible for perpetuating that myth that some people are special because they want to feel special.
Mm.
So I was really, oh man, there's an awful lot to clear up here. So I end up in the book, in the first few pages, taking a lot of these myths and misunderstandings and trying to clear them up. It's just like, right, this whole idea of creativity being binary, let's put that to one side. That's nonsense. So
chapter one, the debunker.
Yes. Yeah. So it's all about debunking the first chapter, that, and then trying to clarify what we mean by creativity. Because after I was realizing there was a problem, a couple of years ago, I set up a web page that just said, what is creativity? And don't consult a dictionary, don't Google it, just start typing. And I got 400 and something or other responses to it.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all pretty crap.
Right.
And they showed so much misunderstanding. So that was actually, those misunderstandings led to this first chapter of the book. It's just like, right, let's clear some nonsense up. Because there is so much nonsense that people just don't understand about creativity. And then I go on to just expand on what it is. I look at the psychology of why it's been important to the development of humanity, in fact, how it's created us. And so there's a little bit of evolutionary psychology in there. Then I touch on social psychology towards the end when it's about how we get groups of people to work together to get the best ideas out of them. So I cover quite a few different areas. I look at the idea of creativity both as a personal thing and as a thing within an organization. And you have to look at these things very differently. And people haven't really been splitting it up in that way. They just talk about creativity as this amorphous thing.
Mm.
And we need to start breaking it down and categorizing it, because what leads to great personal creativity is actually quite different to what leads to great creativity in an organization.
Okay, and then also, I guess, one of the points, like you touched upon brainstorms, okay? I mean, just as a take, brainstorms, they just don't work, do they?
No.
They always track things down.
They're 77 years old,
mm.
Created by an old advertising guy.
He'd be really old now, wouldn't he?
Very old now. He's been mouldering for a while, and it's. It was good at the time, but it became a cult thing, and even very quickly it became such a cult thing in business that academics thought they would start studying this to see what it is, and very quickly they started to realize that it was nonsense. I mean, we're talking about back in the 1940s, they're looking at this and going, you know, this actually isn't great. And there's been about 100 academic studies in the time serious academic studies in the time that brainstorms have been around that pretty much unanimously debunk it as a load of nonsense.
Right.
Of course, there are some studies that will look at it and they look at particular facets of it and look at how to improve it. But to be honest, you have to take it back to look, is this a good thing? And you look at how people respond in a room. You have to understand that your job to come up with creative ideas is to come up with non-obvious ideas. So the way that I categorize where creativity lies is on two, we've got two axes. So on the vertical axis, we've got non-obviousness. So at the bottom, we've got obviousness. And any idea that's obvious has taken no work to get to. It's mm-hmm. kind of your first idea.
Yep.
It takes work to get to the non-obvious stuff. And then the axis that goes horizontally is value. And, you know, going from little value to lots of value. So it means that you want to kind of be up in the top right. You want to be in that area which is giving you value and it's non-obvious. Because that's going to allow you to have a market advantage. It's going to allow you to differentiate yourself. But the problem is that brainstorms, what tends to happen is that people bounce around the office. There's someone that's too chirpy. It's always about 10 o'clock in the morning. Somebody's just a bit too chirpy and they don't just walk. They bounce around the office going, brainstorm, brainstorm, anyone free? Brainstorm, there's biscuits. You know, and sort of try and get people into the conference room for half an hour or an hour. And only then, when they've already selected the slackers in the company to come into the room, only then do they give them the brief. And the brief is usually crap. They just tell them the problem.
Yeah.
There's no insight in there. There's no research that's gone into it. It's just rubbish. And then they say, ideas. And they stand in front of the flip chart waiting for ideas. And, of course, because many people feel uncomfortable with silence, they fill the silence. And they fill the silence with first thoughts. Obvious ideas. First thoughts. First thoughts belong in the bin. And that's kind of what you tend to get out of a brainstorm. You also get people, the ones who tend to be more mouthy, are the ones who actually they're saying, you know, well, there was this great thing that I saw elsewhere and it was just this brand did this. So maybe if we did something like that, you know, it's immediately going for some form of plagiarism.
Mm.
And I know that ideas are always a recombination of existing ideas, but generally when you're going for first thoughts and that kind of thing, it's closer to plagiarism. If you're building on an idea, it's not where you take it from, it's where you take it to. You have to take it to someplace. But brainstorms don't do that. It's just taken from. So there's so many issues that we have with it. And even to look at it from the point of view that you've got a room full of people, if you actually curate it well and curate a room full of amazing people who have been well briefed on it, the traditional brainstorm is also rubbish for that because you get what you call production blocking because you've got one person at the front with a flip chart. So one idea is being discussed at any one point. And anyone else coming up with any ideas, they feel, oh, I can't say that, it's a bit of a tangent. They might write it down, but actually forget the gist of it as the conversation moves. So you actually lose a lot of great work.
Mm, and you also get the dynamic, I guess, which I probably want to ease you into, of where people in a room don't necessarily, they want to say something, but they don't say it for fear of appealing stupid.
Yeah,
so it's
yeah.
The thing I've read some stuff you've put together on fear and creativity.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I think is a very interesting.
Well, fear is the big killer of creativity. It's the one thing that kills it. But there can be numerous fears that go into that. There can be the fear of being seen to be different, the fear that I might look like an idiot. But also there's other fears, the fear that actually this might be quite good and it might be chosen, and that means that I'll have to put extra work in. The fear that...
That's a weird fear.
Oh, there's a lot of people have that fear.
Okay.
There's a fear of... this is going to be hard to sell to the people above me. This looks like a lot of work. So there's lots of different fears that can stop people from sharing ideas. And if you, it's all about output. If you don't share ideas, you create a blockage and you end up not being able to have them. So there are a lot of people who have spoken to have described that to me, that feeling where they try and come up with an idea and it's just blank. They're just, and is this, there's a paralysis of fear that people can get, but also when you're not using that muscle, the muscle atrophies and you find it harder to come up with ideas. But the whole thing starts with fear. And there's been studies done into this with kids. And you find if you get a five-year-old and you give them a pack of crayons and you ask them to draw a space alien, they will. They'll just go wild and they draw you something with 17 arms and 12 eyes and all the rest. And, you know, their imagination goes wild and it looks horrendous. It's crap. But, you know, they're fearless. Round about the age of eight, you ask them, give them a pack of crayons and ask them to draw a space alien, and they'll be like, what do you mean by that? I don't understand. What? He's better at drawing than me. And then if they do start drawing, they'll start to draw things that are familiar to them that they've seen before.
Yeah.
So they might draw a space alien that they've seen in a cartoon, or they might try to draw E.T., or they might... So at that point, they are... It's all about reference. Stuff that they're referring to, they're not thinking wildly. And there's an exercise that I'll sometimes do when I'm speaking to groups of people to explain this to them. And I'll say, right, okay, you've got 30 seconds. I want you to think of a superpower. So you give them 30 seconds, and I usually have the countdown clock. Okay, what's your... Go around the room. What's your superpower? And I go, oh, invisibility. Great, great. What's your superpower? Flight. What's your superpower? Strength. And I then sort of put up a slide, and it's got like eight superpowers on it. And I said, right, everything you've mentioned is up there. Nobody came up with the superpower of the ability to sneeze 5 pound knots. Nobody came up with the superpower which was that you could fart an aphrodisiac. I mean, what's going on here?
Did anyone come up with the superpower to change your yogurt into urine?
No, I've got that superpower.
Or vice versa.
I can do backwards.
Actually, you can be absolutely.
I've not tried it backwards.
Again, that's that thing about people. Again, the instantaneous thought is to go to the obvious, the familiar, the things, the frame of reference is already there.
Yes.
Never to go, that's very hard. Well, I think we might argue here that can be trained into you.
And it can. I believe that anyone can learn to come up with better ideas. No matter how good they are. I mean, even people are fantastic at creative ideas. I can show them exercises that will improve their creativity. It's because it's as simple as input, process, output.
Yeah.
And as I'm saying, when people ask me to go in and talk about brainstorm techniques, they're talking about process. But input is more important than the process. So we were talking about data. If you've got the brand new supercomputer from IBM that I believe has still got that sort of new car smell to it.
Mm-hmm.
It was only a couple of months old. And then you've got the Raspberry Pi that's, what, 15 quid, 20 quid, something like that. And you've got an algorithm running on both of those, and you've got a really shitty data set, and you put that through both of those machines at either end of the power scale, you're going to get shitty data out of both of them. Shitty results, because... Garbage in, garbage out. Shitty input, shitty output. If you've got a really good, clean, insightful data set, and you put it through both these machines, you'll get great results from both of them. It's just that one will be slightly faster than the other. We're not judging this by speed, we're judging it by quality. So, in that way, the input is far, far more important. And I've been working with people over the last few years to show them how to improve their input in a way that it will have a really big effect on their output.
So would you say, perhaps a quick example of these people, have you seen subsequently businesses age, what they create, that has had the sort of manifestation in them?
Ways? I mean, I can demonstrate it to them in about 4 hours and show them at the end of 4 hours, just ask them, have you come up with ideas today you wouldn't normally come up with? And the answer is always yes.
Do they chair you out of the room at this point?
I always get carried out the room on people's shoulders.
I expect it's in your contract,
yeah,
isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, it's that as well as the... I always want a smoke machine and to be lowered from the ceiling on wires.
We're still talking about that in Bristol right now. Now, since you are a maelstrom of creativity...
I'd love the idea that a woman can be a female strong.
Yeah, that's what you're saying.
That's
a femstrom of creativity. Would that be what it was?
A femalestrom.
Maybe, maybe. See, you just can't stop. What have you got up and coming? I mean, are you still on that? When you got a book, it's doing all right, this book, isn't it? Is that fair to say?
It's doing all right, yeah.
You're a publisher.
I've sold a few thousand.
Yeah, well, that's deemed to be doing all right, yeah?
Yeah.
And it's had praise, you know, beyond, right?
Yeah.
That always tells me the pressure of the agent.
What's the second album
come
thing?
Come on, burst, what you got? What's your follow-up?
Actually, I've got...
If this was a Beatles album, I can only are you familiar with the kind of course you are, right? The rough sequence of Beatles albums.
Yeah.
Along that spectrum from, you know, Please Please Me all the way to... Where is this and that?
I don't know. Is it Revolver?
Have you... So we haven't hit Peppers yet?
No, no, no,
still,
no, no.
Still exploring.
I think so. You see, this book is my stake in the sand right now.
Right.
It may be that I read this book in 5 years' time and I disagree with a quarter of it.
I think that'd be a fantastic book 5 years
from now. And that, to me, would be a triumph. Because it would mean that I have pushed my own thinking forward and discovered new things.
Yeah.
So it's kind of my... I'm totally behind everything in this book right now. I'm a real believer in it, and I'm applying it to businesses, and it's working. But I would love it if there's stuff in here that I can look back and disagree with. So it's one of the reasons for that. I'm starting to do more work with academia. It's one of the things that happens when you write books. You're welcomed more by academia for conversations, for doing lectures and things. So I've partnered with a university in Ukraine to do a study into the state of flow in managers. And we're working in the data and the report of that. We're going to be bringing that out as a proper academic paper in the next few months. So I'm interested in doing research to try and discover new things that I've not discovered before. So I'm really interested, particularly around how we can get people within organizations to come up with better ideas. That's my big area of interest.
Yeah.
I'm also interested in personal creativity and the way that we're affected by environments, particularly, but I'm really really interested in management techniques, processes within companies, how to brief people to come up with ideas and
that's also, a podcast also how to, in itself, isn't it?
Yeah, how to feed people's minds and all sorts of things. So there's loads of research that I'm wanting to do, and I've got a couple of other universities I'm talking to about that as well. So that's part of what I'm doing, is trying to push my knowledge forward and ask questions and answer them. And I guess that's curiosity is what that is. And curiosity is the foundation of creativity.
Well, that's one of the sound bites of this podcast. Hey, lab coat day. Now, I've got to ask this question, right? Because part of what we do at Tiny Giant is this thing about taking machine data output, right, in some sort of field, be it sort of food or drink or it'd be anything really, and then actually taking human beings who curate it and do stuff with it. It could be poetry, it could be art, all that sort of stuff, and we do a whole bunch of this, and I thought, as a sort of doyen of creativity, how do you feel, because obviously the machines aren't going away, how do you feel about the interrelationship between the power of machine and the sort of mental agility of the human? Is that ultimately going to be better than just the human?
This, again, people with this debate have been looking at this as a binary thing and saying that humans can be creative and computers can't. Now, creativity isn't one thing. It's a whole bunch of different skills. And some of those things, computers are better at than humans.
Mm.
So, for example, pattern recognition from data. I mean, it's incredible that computers can find patterns in data that humans can't, but pattern recognition is actually a creative skill. It's part of what makes us good at doing stuff. Spotting these patterns to then work out, to imagine the future based on that pattern. So that's one facet of creativity. So in that sense, computers are already ahead of us at some of these skills. So taking it as this binary thing is a problem, because I think the future is collaborating with computers, and I think Adobe are doing a particularly good job at this at the moment. So as somebody who's spent more hours of his life than he would care to admit cutting around objects in Photoshop, Adobe have now created an AI system within Photoshop that can actually do a lot of that work for you. It's extraordinary. It can find, it can say that I reckon this is the main object in the scene, and it will do its best to cut around it. It's not always hugely accurate, but what it will do is it'll give you a starting point. It'll have done most of the work for you. You just have to adjust it.
You finesse.
So that is a beautiful thing. Of that is one thing that we would consider to be creative production skill, and computers are helping us with that. So at the moment, they will be helping us with... that was my wooden leg falling off there. I'll just put it back on. They will be able to help us with a lot of that grunt work, the creative grunt work of production. And that's where we are just now. But the idea that computers won't be able to come up with non-obvious ideas or artistic ideas is ridiculous. They can't do it yet, but they are making inroads year on year. And there's actually one of the things that we're finding is with creativity itself, the idea of the lone genius is something that's very much dying. So it used to be that we'd go, oh, Edison, you know, he was just a genius. He was just, you know, he's just one man, just so many ideas, all these patents he did. He changed it. Actually, Edison was a bit of a BS artist. Like even the light bulb, he set a team on it in Menlo Park, and he didn't invent the light bulb at all. The light bulb had been invented a few years before, and people were trying to find the right material for the filament. So he put a team on it in Menlo Park, and this team were trying everything from like ginger beard hair to all bamboo, all sorts of things, until they came across the idea of carbonized thread.
Yeah.
And that became the filament that worked, that lasted for months rather than minutes, which is the previous record for the filament. So he was fortunate, but of course he took full credit for it as the guy.
History is always written by the winners, as they say.
So there was an awful lot of BS around that. But what we've discovered when it comes to academic documents and patents, that in the last 50 years, there's been a huge increase in collaboration. Going from the single thinker who puts a patent or puts out an academic paper to now the average number of people involved has risen dramatically. There's huge amounts of papers, you know, tend to be done by teams these days. And the most successful papers also are done by teams. So there's a correlation between quality of paper and the amount of people working on it. And the thinking behind this is actually the world's getting more complex. We've divided topics into specialisms.
Yeah.
And then we're dividing these specialisms into specialisms and those specialisms into specialisms. And as things keep fracturing, you need to become a specialist in a micro area. That means if you want to solve a bigger problem, it takes more specialists to come together to collaborate to solve a problem. Yes. The next stage is collaborating with technology. So technology can help us with these things. And rather than trying to say humans are creative and technology isn't, we need to be looking at how we can collaborate with technology to solve bigger and more complex problems.
Well, I will say to you, Dave, that I know for a fact, right? I can test it out, that the tiny giant neural network is a much better poet than me.
Yeah.
For a fact. I long to it. Hey, so look, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on board today.
It's been a slight pleasure. Let's keep it down.
Absolute.
It means it's on the pleasure scale. It was 100%. You know, I think
it was for me.
Was it? I think that
you might. I'm easily pleased.
I think you need to get out more. I'd rather you give me sort of 4.7 on TripAdvisor.
Okay, I'll say it's been an acceptable pleasure with you today. One which I would be more than happy to have an encore at some point in the future, probably when your next book's out, which is probably next week.
It's yesterday. Yesterday, seriously.
No, what? No, he's not yet. You aren't telling. Yes, that's fact.
No, this is true.
See, I told you.
There's one of my books come out yesterday in Macedonia. So it's in Macedonian, and it's not available in English. I've not released it in the UK.
Okay, well, that's fairly available. Niche. Well, not for Macedonia. What? Why is that?
They published another of my books last year, translated it into Macedonian.
Yeah.
And for this one, I said, look, I'll give you a book I've not released anywhere else. And they took it and translated it and released it yesterday. So,
does that mean you've got to you'll be heading out there for a slew of media engagements?
No, last time I was over for the last book was November. They brought out a translation of my book, A User Guide to the Creative Mind. And when I went over there, I got out at the airport and was immediately taken to a TV station. I did breakfast show. I was interviewed for half an hour on the breakfast show, a national television in Macedonia.
Well, one might argue that's kind of a quality, not the typical breakfast show fare, but actually not a vast improvement on the typical.
Yes, I mean the one fantastic thing about their breakfast shows, Piers Morgan was nowhere to be seen. Nowhere to be seen. So yeah, that was interesting. And then from there to a big conference in the region. And then in the evening, we did a book launch in the best bookshop in Macedonia.
So
and
you are basically a big deal in Macedonia.
I am a big deal. No, I'm not. if any of my Macedonian friends are listening to this, I love you. I will hopefully see you soon.
Well, thank you. To be honest, it's been no pleasure at all.
Thank you.
I'm a flip-flop.
I think it's been tolerable. And, I'm glad that you've cleared this whole thing up now. And now know it's called Tiny Giant, because as a dyslexic, I thought your company was called Tony Grant.
that's the empty. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Cheers.